Today's guest is Paul Ross. Paul is the founder of the Citizens Dividend Organisation, which is a not-for-profit organisation with the primary purpose of advocating for the introduction of a universal basic income policy here in Australia. I've followed the universal basic income, or UBI, conversation around the world over recent times, particularly Andrew Yang's contribution during the Democratic primaries in the US. I think Paul has some significant value to add in this debate. He has thought broadly and deeply about the subject, both from a social science perspective and also an economic perspective. Whilst I've been curious about a UBI, I've also been sceptical. But Paul's logic and reasoning has most certainly shifted me into the, okay, maybe, camp, if there is such a thing. I encourage you to lay down any political ideology you may have for a moment and to listen to Paul's arguments. You may just find yourself as curious about it as me. I hope you enjoy. This is David Hobart from Beyond the Obvious, the podcast in search of unexpected insights for investment professionals. Paul, thank you so much for making the time to talk to me today. It's a really timely conversation. There's a lot of talk brewing in the world at the minute about the universal basic income, given government responses to what's going on with this coronavirus. So I couldn't think of a more timely conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you for the invitation, Dave.
Oh, pleasure. Pleasure. So, Paul, why don't we get straight into sort of, for those that aren't aware of what a universal basic income is or a UBI, perhaps you could give us a quick summary of, you know, what it is or what it is to you.
Yeah, the universal basic income has been around for a long time. It's being rebadged as the universal survival income because that's what it's particularly pointed at, giving everybody who's not incarcerated, so who's not in jail or and is in country, not overseas on holiday or something, a certain amount of money which will cover their survival expenses. That amount is we're pitching it at $18,000 per year for an adult, $1,500 per month, and $500 for a child, which will go to the guardian.
Yeah, right. Well, that that makes sense. So you say it's been around for a while. Like, does it exist in the world, or is it just the idea that's been around for a while?
Yeah, this is that's a really interesting question. I mean, there's no country that has it currently, and this is the bottleneck, frankly. I mean, theoretically, it's a magnificent idea, which crosses the spectrum, frankly, from far left to far right. Everyone can appreciate it. But it's a bit like the other, what we call the universal opportunity infrastructure. There's four cornerstones. One is universal liberal democracy. The second is universal education. The third is universal healthcare. And the last is the universal basic income or survival income. So if you consider that before we had democracy, the idea of having it would have been revolutionary, and it would have been scary. I mean, back in those times, it was perceived, commonly perceived, that, for example, if everyone could vote, then everyone would vote to cancel their debts.
Yeah, sure.
So it was quite a scary concept. But once it was implemented, well, we've gone from strength to strength. So we believe that this is a similar situation.
Well, certainly, as you say, we have universal democracy. I mean, it's not universal around the globe, but you know, there's a good part of the West has got an implemented democracy, and then a good part of that, those democratic systems, not all, have got a universal healthcare and a universal education system. So obviously, the US is not the same as Australia in that context, but so you're suggesting that the thing that's missing in, what did you call it, the universal opportunity
infrastructure,
universal opportunity infrastructure, the thing that is missing is a universal basic income or universal survival income.
That's so precisely correct.
So why is that, Paul? What's the what is it about the and if it's okay, I'll call it the UBI.
Yes,
what is it about a UBI that, you know, is essential to filling out that universal opportunity infrastructure?
The universal basic income impacts directly at an individual's psychology. The individual must survive, and that's the first thing. So they actually, it comes back to natural morality. So natural morality is the idea that society's evolved through individuals volunteering to put society before themselves.
Right, so a sort of a collectivism sort of idea, like a Japanese or you know, certain Eastern cultures have got more of a collectivist approach versus, you know, the Western libertarian, almost, you know, individualistic kind of approach to, you know, life.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can even take it back further. So not even talking about humans, but just in nature, whether you're talking about bacteria or bees or coral, the idea is that through evolution, even though every individual is, if you like, competing in order to survive and to distribute its genes, it turns out that in many instances amongst many species, this ability to compete is maximised by cooperating in societies.
So, interesting.
So they give up their direct survival input in order to get an indirect survival benefit from the group. So
right. So how does that work? How do you translate that into the UBI then?
So what the UBI does is that without the UBI, so in the UBI's absence, what happens is the individual cannot do that. It cannot put society first. It must put itself first until it gets that survival income. So this is a violation of nature. It's a violation of the definition of society. It's a violation of natural morality, for that matter. This is the problem. And so once you get that precedent of people putting themselves before society, which they must do in this situation, they're forced to do this, that creates many, many problems. I mean, first of all, what it does is it herds people into two groups. The first group is survivalists. So these people are really struggling to get that income, and they cannot focus on anything else. They cannot focus on environmental problems or anything. And in fact, these people are highly likely to drift into crime. I mean, we've seen a month or two ago a young Aboriginal lad who was reportedly a thief, and you know, a massive tragedy happened where he was killed while being arrested. Now that's complete. You know, that's ruined two sets of families. And it's also become a monument to another monument to Aboriginal, non-Aboriginal division. I believe if he had a UBI, for example, and he had an opportunity to contribute to society, then he wouldn't have even been a thief. So we would have, you know, the whole scenario would have been avoided. So that's one category of people is the survivalists. The second category is the materialists. Because there's a massive social status imperative or a social status benefit to income and therefore career, people spend a lot of time and a lot of energy, a lot of focus in the area of gaining income over and above their survival income and their career. And, of course, this does no benefits to the environment and to many other issues. So that's where it starts.
So the UBI clearly impacts the survivalists. So if people have got a monthly stipend that they can rely on such that they're, you know, off the poverty line, they can feed themselves. Mm. But how does it impact materialists?
Well, materialism, as we define it, the Citizens Dividend Organisation defines it as obviously you get benefit from goods and services. So we're using computers now and, you know, we're getting benefit from using those objects.
Sure.
But then there's the added benefit, a social status benefit, of being perceived to be using them or having them. Now, this goes well beyond the enjoyment or utility we get out of the goods and services themselves. And a lot of this relates back to this idea that income's important, because without it, we're going to have a massive problem, because we have to put that first before we put society first. If you take the situation...
So if I'm reading this correctly, so there'll be less materialism because people will recognise that, they'll shift their values in the face of a UBI. Is that a sort of a summary?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Dave. It sums it up perfectly.
Okay, so, and I suppose where we are today, I mean, this recording's occurring late March, in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, and we're seeing government responses where they're increasing welfare payments, which, is a kind of akin to a UBI in some respects, but you're seeing, I'd expect to see through this process people's values shift, and values being... what's important to you. So, I could easily see the argument for materialism taking a beating through this pandemic, or through the other side of this pandemic, because people have reassessed actually what's important to them.
Yeah, I think this is true, and one of the benefits about of the UBI, or one of the further benefits, is it from our calculations, it will actually more than, or at least double, our prosperity. And so this is the other side. Even though, the values are changing and materialism will be less, our prosperity would double. I mean, you've seen this with the first world countries when they adopt liberal democracy and they adopt universal education and they adopt universal health care. Actually, their prosperity increases.
So how do you measure, or how are you referencing prosperity in that context, Paul?
Well, that's a good question. But, I mean, at the moment we've got the way the economy should be in theory is it should be a purely demand-driven entity which is devoted to the efficient production of goods and services we desire. However, at the moment, because of various distortions related to the absence of the UBI, which bubble through, and I don't think we've probably got time to talk about them all.
Sure, sure.
So instead of the purely demand-driven entity in which we efficiently produce the goods and services we desire, what we've got is a partially supply-driven economy, which is incredibly ironic because one of the biggest promoters of this is actually the Liberal Party, which is, this is a very deeply socialist view, that the idea of a jobs for jobs sake economy. Liberals are always very often talking about stronger economy, more jobs.
Yeah.
But, the type of
jobs. So when you say from a supply perspective, so in other words, production is the determinant of demand, perversely. It's not demand itself, it's actually the supply, and then demand has to come and meet supply in our current economy. Is that...
I should be clearer.
My understanding is the thing that's lacking. It's not your description.
So you have a demand for jobs, which comes... Which should come from a demand for goods and services, and therefore, so it's an indirect demand for jobs. You have the demand for the goods and services, and then because that demand exists, firms come in and they have to supply them, and so therefore they demand employees so that they can supply that demand for goods and services. That's a demand-driven economy, which is how it should be. But what we've got now is we've got governments saying, well, we want to have jobs for jobs' sake. So it doesn't matter. They're not focused on whether those jobs actually produce what people want. So, for example, we have constructions like Centrelink, and many public service jobs. They're actually not producing in it. They're not producing clothes or cars or telephones or houses or anything that we actually want. Mm-hmm. But it's a jobs for jobs sake economy.
And so how will that shift under a UBI?
With a UBI, there's no need to have jobs for jobs sake. Everyone's taken care of, which means you can relax. You can have labour market deregulation. This will unleash businesses because at the moment they've got a dual focus. They have to focus on their business, but then they have a social security responsibility in which they're subject to many rules and regulations about hiring and firing, minimum wage rates, all that sort of thing. With the UBI, everybody's looked after, so there's a massive transfer of power to potential employees. They can say to the boss, no, I don't want your job. They can't do that now. They need a job.
Yeah, sure.
But as I say, it also produces a massive... What it does is it irons out the dead weight cost in our dead weight loss in our economy, and it gives a lot of half of it or some major fraction to the people who are employees, and it gives the other part to the bosses. So everybody's better off because it's just it's an efficient economy.
So Paul, we're going to be time starved in this conversation. We'll only obviously scratch the surface here, but how do you expect the UBI to be funded? Okay, everyone's getting paid, so where does that money come from?
Okay, yeah, this is a great question too. With the first thing is that what we have now is a disaster. We have from Centrelink to the Job Search Network, to all the mistakes they make, to all the mental health problems they produce in people, the friction, the means testing, all that is just waste. And worse than waste, it's an own goal economy, because then we have to have more jailers and more police and more health professionals and all the rest of the mental health professionals to look after the results of this disastrous policy. So we can call this an own goal economy.
Sure.
And that's part of the jobs for jobs sake aspect as well. So with this, it clears away all the waste. So instead of it being a cost, it becomes a transfer. So instead of it being a cost, it becomes a transfer. Now, where does this transfer come from? There's three elements to the way we see it. Currently, we're in 2018 terms. First of all, we need around $350 billion to give every adult $1,500 a month and every child $500 a month over the course of a year. We need $350 billion. Currently, on the system that we have now, we're spending half that. We're spending $175 billion on 2018 figures.
Sure.
So we transfer that's the first element. The second element is that people who are in paid work, they pay tax on their first dollar now.
Yep.
So there's no tax.
So no tax free. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that gets us about $35 billion. The last element is a 20% consumption tax or GST. Now currently we have a 10% one. And the great thing about a GST is that it's difficult to avoid. If a rich person wants to buy a $200 fish for dinner, that's fine, but they're going to be paying, in this case, $40 in the GST. And the other thing is, and from a macroeconomic perspective, is that a GST is very close to non-distortionary. It doesn't change people's decisions too much. If everything goes up by 20%, then the price relativities don't change at all. Unfortunately, with the 10% GST that we have now, we don't get that because there's too many exemptions.
Right. So you're suggesting no exemptions on a 20% GST?
Absolutely. It's all going to be going to the for those people that worry that it's regressive. It's not regressive because, as I say, one, the rich people pay. And the second thing is that the poor will be net beneficiaries. They'll be much better off than they are now.
I can understand that. Oh, but there's also the risk of UBI at $1,500 a month is only going to cover a certain percentage. I don't know what that percentage is. You've probably done the modelling on it, but a certain percentage of their rent and living expenses, for example, and all of which would be subject to a 20% GST. So, you know, you're sort of paying them but then taxing them at the same time. So I don't know whether that's – yeah.
I hear what you're saying with that. One is it includes the concept that, you know, you pay what you can. So, you know, if you're rich, so everyone's paying, everyone's receiving. So I think mm-hmm. we think it's a good thing in terms of the sort of moral underpinning of the individual. They're not getting everything. They're also paying a certain amount according to...
Yeah, sure. And that makes sense.
That's the first thing. But just to answer you directly your question, there are many benefits to this. And one of the benefits is that if you imagine a person who either all their income is the universal basic income or most of their mm-hmm. income is the universal basic income, with rent and accommodation such a massive percentage of that person's, likely outlays.
Yeah.
Of course, they will be looking for cheaper places. And it turns out that in the rural areas, there's a lot of cheap accommodation. So what you'll have is a tendency towards decentralisation, which solves another problem, with our cities being at overcapacity.
Sure.
And with all that labour flowing, you know, people in the countryside staying in the country, spending their money in the country, and people from the cities tending to also go out there, we'll have labour forces in the rural regions and in our north. And companies will say, well, hang on, you know, we've got a labour force out there now. We've got cheap land. Let's go out there and now, you know, we've got labour market deregulation as well. So let's go out there in the new business-friendly environment and do something. So, we could see that it could be beneficial all round.
Yeah, sure. Well, that definitely makes sense. So, Paul, I was curious about the psychological impact of introducing a UBI on, you know, people that have been in, you know, sort of, as you describe, survivalists, so fighting for survival. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden that need is taken care of, which is, you know, by all accounts is a fantastic thing. Over a period of time, as people, you know, become a bit idle, and I say this from personal experience, I my last full-time job was 5 years ago, and I had, you know, I've had a little bit of idle time in that, and I know it's not good for me mm-hmm. psychologically. I need to be actually on the court doing things productively and contributing to society. That's what I need. It's taken me 5 years to get to that place, or not 5 years, but a few years to get to that place. How would you imagine, you know, broadly speaking, if you introduced a UBI, how would you expect people to behave?
Well, I think the first thing is that knowing you and your situation somewhat, you've been doing much more than what you're implying. But anyway, I think one factor is the idea of unpaid work. I think this is we're causing ourselves major problems because we've got a social status premium on paid work over unpaid work, and what that has meant is that we're neglecting the next generation in many cases. So. If you imagine an executive selling ice cream, perhaps, or mm-hmm. marketing ice cream, can it be that we can say that it's more important for them to do that than look after their kids?
Yeah, right.
So to me, the most important job in society is an unpaid carer. That's what I would say first. The other thing is that there's many ways to contribute to society which may or may not be in paid work, volunteering. Having said that, one of the major, I mean, we have something like 5.7 million volunteers in Australia, which is extraordinary. Mm. And one of the reasons for that is that the minimum wages are so high. I mean, at the moment, it's $19.49 per hour. And a lot of people just, you know, their labour isn't worth $19.49 to an employer. So what it means is, you know, instead of getting $10 or $15 an hour, you know, that's illegal, so they have to get zero.
Yeah.
With a UBI, that can be relaxed, and a person's got the UBI, and maybe they get another a bit of other work for $10 an hour or something to add to it if they like.
Yeah, right. No, well, that makes sense. It certainly sounds like it's a shift. It's a big shift in terms of how we currently view. Well, it's almost, it's just a shift of values, isn't it? Right. As a society, what do we value most? And you know, your comment there regarding volunteers and also, you know, unpaid carers.
Yes.
As being the most valuable jobs in society, yet we're, everything else has a premium, you know, status premium, not to mention a monetary. Yeah, is you know, that's just a fresh approach to how we view the world, and I guess for certainly for a lot of my listeners, that where the rubber meets the road on this will be, what impact does it have on the labour market, and what impact is it going to have fiscally? So can we fund it? And you know, there are a couple of things that you've talked about. I think, I mean, we've only scratched the surface here today, and you know, there's so much more meat on this bone. And Paul, I know you've done a lot of work with the Citizens Dividend Organisation in terms of laying the theoretical and intellectual framework for this. So I know your organisation is not focused on grassroots support. It's more about almost like a think tank trying to influence policymakers and influence elites to shift their thinking in regards to this. Mm-hmm. So where can they find you if they want to find out more information?
Our website is citizens-dividend.org. So that's our website. And if they like, they can sign up to our newsletter.
Sure.
But, you know, we're a non-profit organisation without a revenue stream. And so, as you say, all we're trying to do is to get this policy in, and the sooner that happens, the sooner we, the Citizens Dividend Organisation, can put itself out of existence, and you know, we'll all be happy about that, frankly.
Yeah, good on you, Paul. No, that's great. Mate, I really, really appreciate you taking the time, and I'm sure there's going to be plenty of questions from listeners, and I encourage them to shoot me a note with questions, because there'll be follow-up, and if we need to get you back in for another conversation around this, given that it's very timely nature, well, I'll certainly let you know. So, Paul, thank you again. Really appreciate your time. It's been a great chat, and yeah, good luck with getting the message out.
Thank you very much, David. Really appreciate the invitation.
No problem. That's it for today's episode of Beyond the Obvious. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the podcast, please leave a favourable rating or review in the App Store. If you'd like to get in touch, please reach out to me on LinkedIn. Until next time, hooray.